There's a fifth member.
We're going to call the State Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Thursday, January 31st. We have a lot of testifiers. This is a continuation of the public testimony regarding the governor's budget proposals for the Health and Human Services budget areas. Right now, our list is at 29 testifiers. I think we dropped one, but we're going to get started and try to hold everybody to about 5 minutes in order that we can get through this in an orderly fashion. Once again, this is first blush of governor's budget. Each of these items will come in the form of a bill and be presented, and we will have further, much more detailed discussion of each and every one of these before anything actually winds up in our budget, just as a reminder to members and to the public. With that caveat, welcome to the committee, Sue. State your name for the record and provide your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I'm glad you're doing this in alphabetical order. I do want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. First, we're very thankful that the governor's budget increases by 50% and then 100% for the school-linked mental health grants. Minnesota definitely does it the right way. We address the barriers families face, such as transportation, time, and insurance, by providing grants to mental health providers to treat children and youth in the schools. Providers can bill public and private insurance to help cover the costs and keep it a sustainable model. By using mental health providers and not school employees, we keep a firewall between education and healthcare records. Since this program started, we have treated over 13,000 kids, half of them who have never received services before, and half of them had a serious mental illness. If you haven't heard how much NAMI likes this program, then you haven't been listening. We are also supportive of adding family psychoeducation and care coordination to the medical assistance benefit set. Families need help understanding their child's illness and how to help them. Some of the children have very complex illnesses, and care coordination can keep them safe and well. Expansion of crisis services is also important. However, we would want to make sure that the teams receive specialized training on working with the families of children. After seeing numerous ARMS providers, adult rehab mental health services, close, we are glad to see this issue will be addressed. There has been some talk in the press about the need for more hospital beds, but what we really need are more viable community-based services. Losing ARM providers doesn't help. We are, however, concerned that in a hearing we learned that in order to pay for it, funding for community support programs and the Adult Mental Health Initiative would be reduced. While we would like to see greater oversight over the use of these funds and that they be targeted to evidence-based practices, we think DHS should add some strings to these funds, not reduce them to pay for something that is greatly needed. It feels a little like robbing Peter to pay Paul. We are concerned with the proposals to state-operated services. The devil will be in the details, but why are we establishing state-run transition services instead of contracting with community providers?
Cell phones. The eligibility criteria doesn't make sense because it requires that someone currently have a job, have had reduced hours or pay, or not worked in a year or less. And this is supposed to help people who are not having jobs get a job.
doesn't make sense to me. Their own data show that 65% of pending cases had not responded to outreach efforts to schedule their appointments or had not attended scheduled appointments. The number of missed appointments was high enough to prompt DHS to establish a policy of issuing a denial letter if an applicant missed three scheduled appointments. Finally, let me just say that it's not a secret to anyone in this room that we have a fragile, underfunded mental health system for both children and adults. While we appreciate what is in here, there is a lot that isn't in the budget, including funding for supportive housing, IPS employment, intensive treatment for people experiencing their first psychotic episode, creating more intermediate levels of residential treatment, respite care, workforce development, and more. It troubles me greatly when I receive a call from a dad whose son is being discharged from a hospital to a homeless shelter, and yet he's under commitment. It breaks my heart to talk to a mom whose teenager desperately needs residential treatment and is turned down by the county. It makes me angry to hear from a wife whose husband with bipolar disorder and substance use disorder is being bounced from a CD treatment facility to a mental health treatment facility repeatedly and never referred for integrated dual diagnosis treatment. There is just so much to do. I urge you to continue to work with us to eliminate the major holes and barriers in our mental health system. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abbott. Saw that come through on the email. We'll have a page hand that out. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We represent 144 hospitals statewide and many of our healthcare systems. I'd like to say that we support many, many of the provisions in the governor's budget. Do have a couple concerns that I would like to draw to your attention. First and foremost, though, I think the major component of this bill is the Medicaid expansions, and we strongly support that provision in the bill, and that is the key component of this piece of legislation. There are two populations that will be added to our Medicaid program. One is the one that we've heard a lot of discussion about, the population below 138% of the federal poverty guidelines. This population makes less than $14,000 a year. Many of those folks are already on our Minnesota Care program. So we'd be moving people from Minnesota Care into our Medicaid program. The second population that will now be eligible for Medicaid are children under 275% of the federal poverty limit. So when all of this is added together, we will be expanding our Medicaid population by about 145,000 people and will be moving about 113,000 people from the Minnesota Care program to the Medicaid program. And I just would like to point out why this is so important. This will be a better benefit package for the individuals involved. It will be better for providers because we won't have the $10,000 inpatient cap that is in the Minnesota Care program. It will also be better for our state because we'll be able to leverage the federal dollars associated with the Medicaid program and also probably free up some funds in the Health Care Access Fund. So we strongly support that provision within the governor's budget. As I was driving into the Capitol today, I heard on the radio that the wind chill factor was 30 below zero. And it made me think of the second point that I wanted to make today, and that is regarding our MERC program. Now, you're probably asking, how is the Medical Education and Research Cost Program have anything to do with Minnesota's weather? Well, we are not a net importer of physicians to this state. We basically have to educate our own. And I do have a little statistic, and I brought my cheaters up so I could get this right. According to the Association of the American Medical Colleges, about half of the 200 medical students who graduated from the University of Minnesota last year completed their residencies in Minnesota. Of those, about 72% stayed put. That's the 15th highest in the nation. So what that tells us is that if we can get individuals into our residency programs, they like it here. They'll stay here. But we have to do a better job of getting the graduates from our university into residency programs. So this MERC funding supports our hospitals and clinics, pharmacies that train our next generation of doctors, advanced practice registered nurses, dentists, and pharmacists. The governor's budget has about $12 million in restoration for Merck. I'm also, the Hospital Association is very supportive of the various and numerous small but important provider increases in the bill. There's a 2% increase for inpatient rates, a 5% increase for outpatient rates, a 5% increase for physician rates, and you heard Ms. Aberholden talk about the increases in mental health services, which we also support. Last comments are on the negative side, Mr. Chairman. They're not bad, but two things I'd like to share with the committee. There are savings booked from revisions in the 340B drug program, and this is not a program that a lot of people are familiar with. It's been in place for many years for hospitals that have a high percentage of Medicaid patients. And under the ACA, it was expanded to include children's hospitals as well as critical access hospitals. And basically, it allows hospitals to get pharmaceuticals at a better discount. And under this provision, I think the state wants to get some of that savings from the hospitals. We haven't quite determined what the impact will be, but we've heard from a lot of our hospitals that are very nervous about this. And then the last comment is regarding the savings in the managed care program. And this was a big part of how we balanced the budget last year. And we're not saying that we're opposed to this change, but it's $59 million in savings, and we're not quite sure how much of that will be passed on to providers versus how much is through efficiencies and margins at the health plans. And my last comment, Mr. Chairman, has nothing to do with your budget, but would like to go on record as saying the Hospital Association strongly supports the tobacco tax increases, and we look forward to working on that provision in the Tax Committee. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Krinke.
And I have copies if anybody wants one. So.
Great. Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and we provide advocacy and support for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. First, I'd like to start with the good news, and then I'll end with some of the challenges in the budget. One of the pieces of good news is that in recent court decisions, the 20% relative PCA cut will not go forward. And I want to thank the Department of Human Services in the state of Minnesota for not appealing that decision. So that issue we are now done with. So we want to thank the state very much for that. The next item is Reform 2020, Community First Services and Supports. In 2007, the ARC, with a number of our allies, worked on legislation called Self-Directed Supports Option. So 6 years later, it was kind of shelved for a while after we had done extensive work. It's coming back, and we strongly support the move from PCA services to the Community First Services and Supports, which will create a self-directed option for PCAs. So PCAs, or individuals receiving PCA services, excuse me, those individuals will have an annual budget, and they'll have more flexibility on what they can spend that budget on, including items that replace human assistance, such as modifications, technology, and that type of thing. And so we applaud the governor's budget for including that in his budget. PCA services are for, there's about 20,000 people or approaching 20,000 that receive them, and it's a backbone program for persons with disabilities to remain in the community. We also strongly support in the governor's budget intensive services for children with autism, which is funded at $12 million. This also is long overdue, and the ARC Greater Twin Cities, for example, our chapter that works in the Twin Cities area, two-thirds of their advocacy cases are for individuals with autism. And so this is a highly growing area, one in 88 children, and this will be a great step to move forward in that particular area. The governor's budget also includes a titled area called Waiver Management Improvements. And this will help manage the moratorium and help manage waivered services. We can't have dollars sitting in one county when they could be used in another county. And so we fully support better management of this so that individuals that are waiting for a home to move into can access that and benefit from those waiver dollars. And so we support this strongly. Also in the governor's budget is the quality assurance initiatives, and they're covering several areas. One called Positive Practice and Behavior Safeguards and Supports, which will create training for staff and for individuals, but it'll also work to eliminate the use of restraint and seclusion, which has been problematic in the recent past here. The budget also supports the Quality Council, in which we worked on legislation that was passed in 2011. And we think it's very important that we have a Quality Council so that we provide oversight to all of the programs and the hundreds of thousands of people that are benefiting from that program. There is a report coming out tomorrow in the Quality Council, which I serve on, which we'll be reviewing. And one of the other recommendations that was not funded was the necessity for regional councils, in which counties work with stakeholders to manage quality assurance programs statewide and get the input of persons with disabilities. And there'll be further testimony on that from testifiers that are coming up after me. And finally, in the past 10 years, hundreds of millions of dollars have been cut from our programs. In fact, this year it even gets worse. Under current law, our programs will have a 1.67% reduction for 6 months, July 1st, 2013 to December 31st, 2013. These cuts have meant long waiting lists for our waiver programs, individuals are no increases in wages for direct support professionals, and limits on the number of days some individuals can attend their day training and habilitation and employment programs. There is plenty of talk at the Capitol about restoring the school shift, as there should be, but there is no talk at the Capitol about the disability shift, which has caused a rise in parental fees. It's caused direct support professionals either to take cuts or no wage increases, and it has caused individuals with disabilities to unnecessarily stay in institutions longer than they should be. So we will work with the committee members, we will work with the governor, we will work with all stakeholders to try to address the disability shift in our budget as we work through the 2013 legislative session. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Melinda Hugdahl with Legal Services, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Melinda Hugdahl with Legal Services, and as some of you know, I wear several different policy topic hats, so I'm going to hit on a few different points within the budget pages, primarily child care, human services licensing, and then the child permanency area. Working with many of you over the years and getting to know many of you who are new to the committee, I know that all of us share that we all care about kids and we want to make sure that kids have good outcomes, they're doing well, especially our most at-risk kids. And so as we talk about a lot of big picture pieces of the budget, we all want safety, we all want school readiness. Those are a lot of themes we've heard a lot about. We fully support that. But we also want to make sure that there's access, because access is a critical piece in helping these at-risk kids get the services and the early ed supports that they need. Child care assistance, for those of you who are not as familiar with the program, it helps parents work. It gives kids the early education benefits that you'll hear a lot of people talk about in the committee. So it's really a program that gives really good value for the dollar that is put into the program, because it yields multiple benefits to not only the families but to all of us. If these kids are not in child care, they are all the good steps that we are doing in early ed and school readiness for these most at-risk low-income kids don't benefit the kids we're trying to reach most. So in the big picture, you have to see these pieces together. We are disappointed to see that basic sliding fee didn't receive more funds to move families off the waiting list, because obviously that's the most direct impact on access, is having families actually be able to use the program. I think, as most of you know, there's a waiting list of several thousand families statewide to access this program so that they can get into good quality child care and parents can work. As part of the Parent Aware program, which is the quality rating system for child care providers, and I'm sure you'll hear more about that, there is a proposal in the budget to give higher rated providers a higher rate. This is a good thing from our perspective because it helps in that balance that I talked about. One of the pieces in how licensing fits into is there are only limited slots available in any child care setting. And so we want to make sure that as we focus on our early education pieces and for the kids who need those supports the most, they're able to access those slots. So by putting the additional dollars to providers who are higher rated, it helps incentivize them to want to have the child care assistance slots available for those kids, because eventually what we're concerned about is not having the private pay families and the child care assistance families all fighting for the same limited slots, and then the money we're putting into the program isn't reaching the kids we're trying to reach most. So as we look at this in the big picture, we're trying to make sure that that those dollars are targeted and there are enough protections in the system to make sure that we're reaching the kids that we're intending to reach. In the licensing provision that deals with child care, really our piece of it is really the access piece. And you're going to hear a lot more from a lot of other providers and other folks about some of the pieces of the budget pages. Our piece of it is really this simple. To the extent that we have providers available for these kids so parents can go to work, that's what we need. It gets back to access. So to the extent that the provider community feels that the requirements become too onerous and they either close their business or they stop taking children on child care assistance, that harms our clients who are primarily the parents involved. So in the big picture, that's what I ask you to keep in mind. And from our perspective, it's the balance. We're not involved in the detail of some of those, but that's our interest in it. In the bigger picture of licensing, one provision that we are looking to work with the department on, and we haven't seen the exact language, it's an overview at this point, that the department has asked for access to the MNSA system, which is the court information service, to get arrest records. We understand a little bit of what they're doing. We're looking to talk more with the department. Some of you know over time we've had some concerns about how broad the access and use of arrest and non-conviction records is in the human services licensing area. And so we're going to be working with the department, and Mr. Kerber and I have had some really good conversations. So we'll, part of it is us understanding more exactly how this is going to play out, but we did want to just raise the issue at this point that that does expand some access. On the child permanency front, one of the provisions that we really want to pay close attention to is the North Star Act for Children. There are some really good ideas in there, and we want to thank the department and the governor for bringing this idea forward. It's something that's been around for a long time. And I think, again, it gets back to the fact that we all want to see these kids who are in, a lot of them are very at risk, they're in child permanency placements, to have the best outcomes we can. And so this gives us a really good opportunity to talk about how to best serve these kids, how to make programs better. We haven't seen specific language yet, but really we'd like to see a scheme that meets the needs of all of the kids who are in these placements. And there's a big variety of children and their environments and the services that they need. And a lot of times the payments are really based on what kind of services these children need. And so we pay particular attention to all of the kids. But we really want to take a good hard look at those kids who are the most highly traumatized, who have maybe other issues as well, who need really additional services. And we want to make sure that the families who are caring for those children have the resources that they need for those high, what they call difficulty of care cases, so that those services are out there and those families are able to provide for those kids. So we look forward to working with the department on it and seeing where the discussion goes with how to better improve all of those payment options for different families. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it.
Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. Alex Fitzsimmons with the Children's Defense Fund. And next, just so folks know, are going to be coming Anna Youngerman with Children's Hospital and Danielle Evans with Child Care Works. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and
Bishop
members
Price
of the...
Price characters there.
Yes, some old ones.
Yes.
But thank you, Mr. Chair. I only have about 50 more of these to set up, so it'll just take a minute. And I'm just kidding. Okay. But thank you. Good morning. My name is Alex Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. In addition to research, outreach, and youth development work, we develop and advocate for policies that seek to improve the well-being of Minnesota children. And so today I'm here to comment on a few pieces of the governor's proposed budget. We support many of the pieces, the statewide expansion of PSOP, looking at the child care rates to improve access, mental health services, and the provisions concerning MFIP. And that's actually where I'm going to focus today. But before I do that, I encourage members to keep in mind the mission of the Department of Human Services. And the mission is to help people meet basic needs so that people can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. And the first value that DHS outlines after stating what their mission is to focus on people and not programs. And so that brings me to our MFIP program. So we agree and support the governor's interest in focusing on teen parents and making certain that they have services. We know that they are among some of the most vulnerable in the MFIT program, increasing benefits for families and providing additional supports to better improve employment outcomes. And with that, it's employment outcomes of parents, and that brings me to our group of 10 here that we have. And that what we know, and I know you've heard this many times now already, but that seven out of 10 MFIT recipients are children, and half are under the age of six. And the limited data that we have about children who are receiving MFIT, we know that many of them are at risk for developmental delay. And so when we talk about employment outcomes and we talk about outcomes in general, we talk about our policies and our program goals, how MFIP is right now, it focuses on these three people right here, the workers and the parents. So we have two broad recommendations. The first is to elevate the role of parents within the MFIP program. And the second one is to start seeing and to start focusing our policies on these seven right here. And so to that end, I want to point out two pieces before I briefly lay out a couple policy recommendations that we'd like to see within this framework that the governor's provided on reworking MFIP. There's been a lot of discussion about early education, the importance of early education, expanding the statewide scholarships, which we fully support. But we also have to be looking at the 0 to 3 and these early opportunities, the earliest of opportunities, and be looking at MFIP, where we know that so many children are, that 35,000 children under the age of 6 are receiving MFIP each month. So it's an opportunity to make certain that we're providing the services that these children need so they are ready to succeed in school when they get to school. We also know, again, we have little data about the children in MFIP, but what we do know is that deep poverty, which is poverty defined as half of the federal poverty guidelines, is harming our children. We know that one-third of MFIP children and families are enrolled in special education, so that's focusing on the school-age piece. But another thing that we know from a discontinued pilot about 3 or 4 years ago is that nearly two-thirds of young children in MFIP tested as part of that pilot project screened positive for a potential developmental delay. So there are a number of things that we can do to start seeing our children in the MFIT program. One would be just to make certain that parents are provided information and resources about early childhood development and programs that are available when they're oriented into the program, when they come in for employment reviews, to make child care available for children in child-only cases where there may not be any other early childhood experiences that are available to them. Measuring child outcomes, linking information, linking data across programs, and to not see MFIP as a siloed program or only within the Department of Human Services, but to see the connections across other programs and across other agencies. To repeal the family cap, which I also know you've heard much about, but to repeal the family cap. And to increase the amount of money that families are receiving each month. And one suggestion we have on doing that is to look at the fact that two-thirds of families receiving MFIP need to also cover their housing costs with their cash assistance benefit. So perhaps one opportunity would be to look at a housing allowance. And then one last piece would be to count as work activity parents' attendance at their children's early childhood activities. So that gets to that point of elevating and raising the role of parent, in addition to looking at the role of adult as worker. So as we rework and we rebuild MFIP, focusing on people and not the programs, we must do so in a way that recognizes the role of these three, not just as worker, but as parent. And on the opportunity that we have here and on the opportunity we have to lead the nation in really reworking our MFIT program to serve the people that are most represented in the program. So I look forward to working with you, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons. We look forward to working together as well. Alex Youngerman with Children's Hospital. Anna, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning.
Last week over at Children's
Hospital.
Yes,
you were. That's okay. Yes. My name is Anna Youngerman, and I am the Director of Policy and Advocacy at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. Thank you for having me. As an organization whose mission is to champion the special health needs of children, we're pleased that the governor's budget prioritizes children's health and health care. I want to call attention to a few of those provisions today. First, as Mary Krinke testified to, we're very pleased with the governor's funding for Merck. In 2011, Children's trained over 400 residents and fellows in general pediatrics and pediatric subspecialties, such as cardiac surgery, neurology, and neonatology. As the state's leading pediatric training facility, restoration of Merck funding is critical to maintaining a medical workforce that can respond to unique healthcare needs of children across the state. Unfortunately, after the cuts that were imposed in 2011, we were forced to eliminate several of our programs. And again, because we are the leading pediatric training facility, that has a very obvious effect on training for pediatric specialists and primary care providers across the state. Secondly, the MA Medicaid provider rate increases, while small, we're very appreciative of those increases. And the governor's budget documents referenced the growing gap between the cost of care and reimbursement rates under MA. As an organization that receives 42% of our revenue from Medicaid, which compares to about 5 to 10% for adult systems, we are acutely aware of this imbalance. In 2011, we experienced a $57 million gap between costs and payment. While the proposed rate increases won't come close to filling that gap, it's a start, and it'll help us balance our commitment to serving all kids, regardless of their ability to pay, with our own expectations of advancing innovative, high-quality care. And I'll quickly touch on a few other provisions we support. We're pleased to see some financial support for care coordination. Children's was the state's first certified medical home. We established our healthcare home in 2004. And because of that, we've seen firsthand the incredible benefit to our patients and families when care can be managed, coordinated, and facilitated by a care team. Unfortunately, the reimbursement system hasn't caught up with that. So we support efforts to move Minnesota toward a payment model that rewards outcomes rather than services. We also appreciate the number of funding and program provisions directed towards children's behavioral and mental health. This is, I think everyone agrees, an area we all believe warrants more attention. As the state's leading pediatric provider of oncology care, we're grateful to see the continuation of emergency medical assistance coverage for cancer treatment. We support the renewed focus on population health efforts through the investment in the SHIP program. And lastly, as Mary Krinke talked about, we applaud the governor for his support of a tobacco tax increase as sound health policy. That's exactly how we view it as an organization. We support this policy as an effective deterrent with kids. In fact, for that reason, we would encourage if looking at a slightly larger increase and looking at something like $1.50, because that will prevent more than 47,000 Minnesota kids from smoking. Thank you.
Ms. Youngerman, thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Daniel Evans with Child Care Works.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Evans. I'm the policy director for Child Care Works. Child Care Works is a statewide child care advocacy organization whose mission is to achieve and sustain affordable, high-quality child care options for families and communities. I am pleased to testify today in support of Governor Dayton's budget proposal for fiscal year 2014-15. Leading research in child development distinguishes ages birth to five as a critical period of brain development. The interactions children have with their parents and caregivers during these early years literally build the foundation for a child's school and life success. Thus, the child care experiences an infant, toddler, and preschooler has are a crucial component of a child's eventual kindergarten readiness. Our first priority this session is to strengthen the continuity of care that young children experience, as healthy development depends upon a young child building strong relationships with the adults who care for them, which happens through their daily interactions over time. Our second priority is to ensure that the child care experiences children have are high quality, so we are advocating for state support and standards that encourage child care providers to make quality investment in their child care services. We are pleased to see these priorities reflected in Governor Dayton's budget. The first area where we see this is in the Child Care Assistance Program. This program, as we've talked about, provides critical child care assistance to low-income families in Minnesota. The first goal of this system is to provide work support. However, the program also provides needed care for over 35,000 children, many of whom are high risk. The increase in funding for the basic sliding fee and MFIP portions of the CCAP program, while small, will help achieve many important outcomes. Under the governor's budget, all parents under 21 years of age with CCAP eligibility will be assured the opportunity to complete their GED or high school education with child care assistance. Under the MFIP portion of it, the parents will be guaranteed that they won't go on the waiting list that we've discussed under CCAP. They will definitely have that child care they need to help them work. So given that, they'll be able to fully participate in the state economy and be given the opportunity to provide for their families. The policies proposed in the governor's budget will also simplify and strengthen reimbursement rates for CCAP providers. These changes will move us from unique rates for each Minnesota county to a cluster model that groups each Minnesota county into one of four rate groups. This simplification will help with administration and will help child care providers understand the system. The increased rate funding levels in the governor's budget will prevent any CCAP providers from experiencing declined rates, while many will see increases. These increases will still leave many Minnesota CCAP providers with reimbursement levels short of the local market rate, but they will begin to address the disparity between CCAP rates and market rates that's developed over the years. The budget also establishes reimbursement differentials to those programs that have demonstrated the highest quality through the parent aware rating process. The 15% differential above that top level for 3-star programs and the 20% differential for 4-star programs will compensate providers for providing care at the highest standard. In addition, rate differentials will incentivize lower-rated providers to pursue quality improvements. The policies in the governor's budget further support quality improvement in childcare by funding early learning scholarships for childcare providers in the parent-aware quality improvement process. We call the Mini Minds campaign. This investment will encourage families to place their children with rated providers while building in additional incentives for providers to enter this process. This approach will help us build capacity in the parent-aware system and give low-income children continuity of care in a high-quality child care environment. This important item is in the education budget of the portion of the budget. In regard to the licensing changes proposed in response to the infant mortality panel report, we are extremely concerned with the increase in infant deaths in child care in Minnesota. We welcome the opportunity to enhance the training of our child care workforce, as such steps should engender greater safety for our children and higher quality in care. However, many child care providers are struggling to keep their doors open. To ensure the continuing viability of our child care providers, we need to commit sufficient resources to support new training requirements. We are concerned that the $750,000 currently budgeted to offset new training costs is not adequate to underwrite substantially increased training requirements for over 10,000 licensed family child care providers. We want the licensed family child care providers to stay open to benefit from all the things the new training will bring us and to benefit from increased safety for infants and children. It is our shared responsibility to address the infant mortality tragedy with a strong response in terms of policy and resources. We generally support the governor's budget and look forward to working with Health and Human Services Finance Committee throughout the legislative session. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. I have Tom Evanstad on the agenda next. I haven't seen him here. I know that he submitted written testimony, and I provided that in members' packets, and also I forgot to mention at the beginning that there are others that wished to provide testimony that weren't unable to attend either yesterday or today, and their testimony has been provided in writing, and you will find that in your packets. And not seeing Mr. Evanstad, I think that Cindy Cunningham and Kathy Smith are both with child care providers, and if you wish to come forward together and coordinate your testimony.
She's watching my one.
Oh, chart. That's fine. That's Sorry, fine. Come forward bring... separately then. Are you
was
both
in
the quandary
still... this morning. What do I do with this infant?
Yeah.
It's a very practical life Welcome. Process. I do have copies of my testimony here, if that would be.
And then just state your name for the record.
That is Cindy Cunningham. I am a licensed child care provider in St. Paul for 15 years. I don't like speaking in groups. I prefer to be home with my children. I've spent many hours reading through the information and data, including the actions against providers where the deaths have occurred. I've asked questions, getting information from DHS, both the state and the county. I've been working with providers from across the state and our state association, MLF-CCA, to attempt to identify the problem and evaluate the recommendations presented by the Infant Mortality Review Committee. The death of even one child is painful for all involved, especially the family members. When a child dies in someone else's care, the child's loved ones have an extremely helpless position as they were not caring for the child at the time of the death. The providers and the care of their and the children in their care have the terrible experience of this death in their home. This child has been a precious part of everyone's lives, and now they are gone. Not one death should be minimized or dismissed. All are significant, and any time a death happens in child care or anywhere else, we must look closely at the circumstances so we can identify what went wrong and make any needed changes to prevent further deaths. There are over 10,000 providers and thousands of children who are safely attended by licensed family child care providers in Minnesota. Unfortunately, many people are looking at the few bad providers in these horrifying instances where a death or injury happens and passing judgment on the family child care profession as a whole. The Child Mortality Committee evaluated the data and put forth recommendations that DHS, the providers, and the public have wrestled with for many months. DHS has listened to providers and the associations that represent us, and their recommendations are not as harsh as the Mortality Review Committee's. However, the problem remains that the committee did not identify what the problem is or was. It has been stated to me that they don't know why there was an increase in deaths in child care, yet they released recommendations, many of which would cripple the family child care profession, even though no scientific data was used to formulate them. The basis for these recommendations is flawed in that no one yet seems to have specifically identified the problem and hence be able to offer a clear solution. The raw data I finally obtained from DHS, which included the cause of death and known circumstances surrounding the death, appears to be flawed in many ways. It includes many deaths where the provider was not at fault and could not have done anything to prevent it from happening. There's an unlicensed provider. One death appears to have been listed twice. There's a child listed with a broken leg that we're not sure was a death. Preventable deaths, which included cancer and pneumonia. There's a case of shaken baby where the parent was actually found to be responsible, and many children with pre-existing health issues. There's also a showing of an inconsistency of licensing enforcement. In the cases where the provider was not following rules and providing poor care, DHS should have been involved prior to the death, and the provider should have changed their practices or not been licensed. Under existing guidelines, there are people that should not be providing care. Many are attempting to improve quality rather than address safety and mortality. When this issue was first brought to light last spring, deaths were happening at a rate of one per month. But when providers got word that there was a problem, we made changes, got the word out through associations reinforcing safe sleep and supervision requirements. My understanding is that there has not been a death since July of last year. What changed? If only we'd been made aware of this problem sooner, perhaps we could have prevented some tragedies from happening. Before any bill is written, please consider these points. One, please reconvene a panel, including providers, that finds why an increase in deaths throughout the 10 years and none since July of 2012. What are the factors in the child's home environment and medical history that contribute to these deaths? What truly could have prevented a death? SIDS is unpreventable and cannot be halted. Then find solutions that fit the problems identified in this comprehensive study. Two, increased oversight and consistency in interpreting guidelines will improve compliance. In the proposal, this was one small statement made regarding increased funding for this portion of the changes. Everything else was in the burden of the providers. Providers need to be held accountable for current rules and any potential changes. Punishment does not change behavior. Supervision and correction processes do. As child care professionals, we are in the business of changing behavior. It is not accomplished by poor supervision and lack of intervention. This would require more DHS staff for more frequent contact with providers. Increased consistency by training licensors is critical. Currently, within counties and between counties, there are differences in interpreting the rules and the guidelines. Three, separate out legislation that is to increase safety, decrease mortality from quality licensing guidelines. Increased training and child development will not prevent injuries and deaths. Safety and mortality prevention areas adopt the AAP recommendations as the standard. Under the portion of restricting loose bedding, please add use of sleep sacks, including swaddle styles. At the current, we cannot put a blanket and swaddle an infant in a crib. If you look, I did include, if you've gotten your testimony, this is what safe sleep looks like. I don't know how many parents really know or understand that this is what our our guidelines are with that, and it is a stark change of behavior for virtually most everybody. Separate out legislation has increased safety, decreased mortality from quality licensing guidelines. Physician's authorization, it's fitting except removing the parent's choice. I have been told of incidents where a doctor directs a sleep practice that is outside of safe sleep practices, and the providers are concerned that they would be held accountable under licensing and have to go against a doctor's order. Written competency exams do not test for skill. As I said, if you look at the pictures of what a safe sleep is, I've been putting children down to bed for 21 years. We all get into a habit about what that looks like and how that happens. To change that behavior causes, you need to have an intervention of physical pattern of behavior change. Increased and improved SIDS, CPR, first aid, and supervision directly address mortality and safety. Yearly is seen as being excessive. Every 2 years would be given the appropriate training, and a scheduled providers could accomplish that training. Baby monitors are not recommended as prevention by the AAP, and many SIDS organizations discourage the use of baby monitors as prevention. This is a false sense of security. Mandating observing a sleeping infant every 30 minutes would be best addressed in training of supervision rather than setting up a regulation that is not always practical and is difficult to enforce as a timed activity. This also sets up a false sense of security. Clarify requirements regarding holding sleeping infants was listed. That is a good example of what the complexities of this issue are. It seems like a strange question, but the term safe sleep environment is what I've shown you in the handout. Providers are already being fined for not using a safe sleep practice. When an infant falls asleep in a stroller while on a walk, in the vehicle, or in the provider's arms during circle time, the infant is not then therefore in a safe sleep environment. So what are we to do? Providers are at risk of being fined or even losing their licenses in these incidents. When does bonding time happen? Physical contact, even when asleep, is critical to a child's development, and no reported deaths happen while holding a child or in a stroller. The AAP recommends standards for routine sleep. What do we do when it is not a routine sleep environment? One of my bad jokes is that if you look at the sleeping thing, one of the requirements is that we have to have a tight-fitting sheet. And there are providers that are being issued fines for not having a tight-fitting sheet. No one will tell us how tight a sheet has to be before we're fined in that. I have a Marine son, and I asked him to help me get my sheets tight on my cribs. We couldn't do it. There isn't, between the manufacturers and the crib standards and everything, to get it as tight as what some people are saying would be impossible. Sleep information given to parents is beneficial to families and in partnering with their providers, but does not replace DHS licensing oversight. Communication between DHS and providers is critical. We work in our homes in cooperation with our parents. Communication such as these safe sleep issues would have prevented deaths if prevented earlier. And finally, DHS and the authors of any forthcoming bill will serve children and families best by openly partnering with providers and our associations. As they are the largest groups representing providers from all corners of the state, they are best equipped to address geographical concerns. Working with providers and drafting a sensible bill makes more sense than putting an impractical bill together and placing unnecessary burden on good family child care providers. Any questions?
Ms. Cunningham, thank you very much for providing your testimony. Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
I know it's always hard for folks to come. I have a question. Do you, any of your providers use a video rather than just an audio for observing a sleeping child?
I am not aware of providers that do use the video monitor part of it.
Okay. The other question I have for you is safe sleeping, I believe, at one time used to be putting babies on their stomachs because the fear was on their backs they might choke. And now we've got, so what is the science for that is making this assumption now that?
Senator Kiffmeyer, as I described in the beginning, we will get into much deeper conversations. This is an overview. We've heard the concerns, and we have 29 testifiers that have come from all over the state, and we just simply will not get through them. There are many controversial things to talk about, and Ms. Cunningham, thank you very much for coming forward, and we will get much deeper into all of these concerns and really appreciate your initial thoughts. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Smith, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Take care of the infant first.
Yes, make sure the child is safe.
Yes.
Very important. beg your, I want to apologize. I am a layperson in this, and so if I offend
This is
anyone,
your house.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Really, if I offend anyone, I apologize right now, okay? Because as I look at the reports, I'm looking at them as a layperson and not as someone who spends time with them. But, dear Chairman Lori and Senate Committee, thank you very much for letting me be here this morning. I'm Kathy Smith. I am the lower school director for Liberty Classical Academy. I maintain two employee-based child care that we delightfully named the Cubbies Program. We've been licensed for 3 years, and I'm also a mother who has two children enrolled in our Cubbies Program. I would like to present to you a few thoughts that I have brought me here and my civic-minded fifth grade class. First of all, let's talk about balancing a budget. Balancing a budget is never an easy task, and my heart goes out to you. I, as an administrator and a teacher at a classical Christian private school, I am also a certified budget counselor, so I've had to sit across the table and do a lot of budget sessions. You always have to ask the important questions. Do we need this? Do we want this? Do we desire it? And when asking those questions, if you stay in the desire category, you're bound to get in trouble. If you stay in the needs category, you're going to feel suffocated by trying to maintain such a tight budget. So you have to find that balance of having good programs and also not spending too much. I also ask that you use your wonderful logic skills that either you receive from your education or those that you've practiced being in office here as you're thinking about each of the recommendations. For example, the DHS presented that they should take the federal grant of the $3 million to improve background checks so that they could make sure that approximately 25 of the 267,000 people that get background checks are discovered soon after they commit a crime. 25 of the 267,000. That's less than 0.1%. $3 million. I know it's a grant, but it doesn't make sense. Secondly, we must address the most heart-wrenching subject, and that is infant death. I know as a mother of three, I spent many hours praying for my babies and counting the days until we might get out of the danger zone of SIDS. It's every mother's nightmare. And for those who have experienced it, we cry with them. But the sacred deaths of those innocent children should not be exploited to further any cause that which is completely and directly attached. It was very evident that their deaths were used to cause confusion and panic about our home daycares in Minnesota, and that was appalling because the facts were not presented correctly. The Minnesota Child Mortality Review Panel's report of August 2012 stated that there were 83 deaths in licensed home care in 10 years. That's atrocious. No wonder that the community and our dedicated senators and representatives were concerned, rightfully so. But wait, if we look closer at that data, we'll see that of those 83, 62, only 62 were sleep-related. And of those, 34 to 40 were violations of the child caregiver, which brings us down to about 28 babies in 10 years. So that's 3 babies a year. The other 40 infants that died from actions of the caregiver, that's about 4 a year. But the information was not presented that plainly, but grouped all the deaths together, whether it was from cancer or accident or any of those things. And because of the inaccurately presented research, we are now going to spend millions of dollars imposing guidelines and on the wrongful doing of 4 people a year onto, I think I heard a bigger number of around 10,000 caregivers. 4 people a year, 10,000 caregivers who right now are following the guidelines that are already set up and providing excellent quality educational care for their little flock. So the next question is, will the recommendations presented by the governor actually reduce deaths in the licensed family child care? First, we have to make sure that the daycares are doing the guidelines that are already established. Just because we add more rules does not mean that the same type of people will ignore them. It only forces the ones who are already following them to get frustrated, become broke, and close their daycares. As an administrator of a school, I know that the only way I'm going to be sure that a teacher is following my request is to observe the classroom. It's the same in childcare. I have a lot of respect for my licensing worker, but we need more compassionate licensing workers who will walk beside and guide us the best we can. Secondly, we must acknowledge that more general training will not stop SIDS. We don't know the cause, nor will it make a bad caregiver good. It will only, but it will line the pockets of certain organizations that are more than happy to take our money and force us to listen to a poorly presented SIDS class. So in closing, I ask that you think about the three budget questions and use your logic. We also need more face time with our licensing worker and a reduction in the financial requirements and penalties that are proposed to be implemented. Finally, Chairman, and most importantly, please do not crush the whole group just to get a message to a few. Please think about the future of home daycare and the impact it will have on our communities if you continue down this path. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate the service that you give our great state.
Ms. Smith, thank you very much. And let me assure you, I don't believe you've offended any of us. And
okay.
It is that balance that we really do strive for and struggle with all together. And thank you for the important work you do with our children, and thank you for bringing some of them to the committee today. I know it brings a smile to all of us when we see it's what we're here for.
Good. We come every May.
Thank you.
You'll see us again. Thank you very much.
I'm going to try to start bringing folks up two at a time because we are running a slightly behind schedule, but I think we'll be okay. If Eric Hagee from AFSCME and Rick Varco from SEIU want to come up together, I believe, Eric, you have an additional testifier with you. Is that correct?
I do. Thank you.
Great. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Eric Haugie with AFSCME Council 5, and I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to give testimony today on the governor's proposed budget. AFSCME Council 5 represents more than 43,000 employees across the state, and it's no exaggeration when I say that most of this budget affects our members, whether it's the people working in DHS central offices here in St. Paul who administer these programs, or county social workers who help people sign up and maneuver public assistance programs, or frontline licensed practical nurses in private nursing homes, hospitals and state-run facilities, or in-home family child care providers waiting through licensing changes, or staff at the sex offender programs in Moose Lake and St. Peter. And many of our seasonal and part-time employees and their families use programs like Minnesota Care because they can't get affordable health care through their employer. These public programs and services provide the safety net for the hardest-to-serve Minnesotans, and for years we've seen them eroded to the bare bone. So it's also no exaggeration when I say that this is by far the best budget to come out of an administration in many years. We're excited about many pieces, and not surprisingly, we will have some questions about other proposals. And like many in this room, we eagerly await the introduction of the legislation to enact these changes. Given the breadth of the impact on our members, I'll try to focus on a few key proposals today. First, we wholeheartedly endorse the governor's proposal to expand medical assistance to serve more families, and we look forward to working on efforts to continue Minnesota Care with the creation of a basic health plan. We then like the financing changes and savings realized in several of the Reform 2020 proposals. We will be watching closely how they are implemented, and especially at the county level, but also making sure that as Minnesota does more to help keep people in their homes and in less restrictive community settings, the staff at the facilities are engaged in a central part of the transition plans. Next, we are pleased to see the long-term care make a noteworthy appearance in the budget, and we hope the proposed rate increase is a starting point. Counties naturally play a role in the delivery of human services, and ensuring this is done in a thoughtful, integrated manner with the funding necessary to provide services is important to AFSCME Council 5. Lastly, we appreciate the governor's investment in child care in this budget. To say more about this and to offer some solutions to help solve the tragedy of children dying, I'll yield the rest of my time to Lisa Thompson, an in-home child care provider here in St. Paul.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Eric Haggie has said, my name is Lisa Thompson, and I provide care for some pretty fabulous children here in St. Paul. I am a 4-star rated program on the Parent Aware rating system, and I'm also a nationally accredited provider. There are more than 11,000 licensed in-home family child care providers in Minnesota, and we are often the first choice and sometimes the only choice for child care throughout the state. As president of Child Care Providers Together with AFSCME, I can report that our members are appreciative of the governor's proposal to increase child care assistance rates and to offer incentives to providers to help improve their quality. The federal government asks that state reimbursement rates meet at least 75% of the current market rates, and Minnesota rates for too long have been stagnant, and right now hover around 30%. That's just unacceptable, and we'll work to ensure that we make progress in this dire situation this year. Now, we know children are better prepared for school and for life when they are in the best quality of care. And it's great to see that the governor acknowledges this by supporting system changes aligned with Parent Aware and to the use of our federal child care development grants and the Race to the Top funding. Parent Aware must continue to improve its work to fully recognize what makes family child care a high-quality learning environment, and it, as it already is, and support family child care providers in earning their Parent Aware stars. While we look forward to a more in-depth discussion on the child mortality legislation, legislative proposals, we do share many of the concerns echoed in this room already today. The solutions lie in engaging providers, engaging licensors, and engaging parents about child safety and safe sleep. Training must be affordable, accessible, and relevant. And wherever possible, designed with the often overlooked experts. That's the providers ourselves. We're the front line. Specific to the jurisdiction of this committee, resources to offset the costs of required professional development as the governor has proposed in his budget are needed and should be a central part of this discussion. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we look forward to working with you to identify and hopefully remove barriers to a robust early childhood system, which in-home family child care is a central part. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Mr. Varco?
Chairman Laurie, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent about 15,000 healthcare workers around the state in hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes. For years, our members have faced a seemingly endless round of deficits and cuts. Throughout it all, our members have tried to work in partnership with our employers to do more with less. I'd like to say all of that has been greater efficiencies, but in a lot of cases, it's just cuts to services and employment. Many a negotiating session with our employer has started with the employer taking out the today's paper and saying, legislature cuts $100 million from hospitals, nursing home funding flat. So the decisions you make here in this room have real consequences to real workers. We're pleased and excited to see that Governor Dayton's budget attempts to break this cycle, and we have an honest, no-gimmicks budget. By assessing funds newly available through the ACA, we're able to hold HHS funding flat but make necessary investments. I'd like to highlight three things we're really happy about in the budget. Several folks have mentioned Medicaid expansion. This isn't just a fiscal imperative. This is a moral imperative. One of our members, Elsie Ehrman, testified before the Healthcare Reform Task Force saying the hardest part of her job was turning away patients. And she spoke in particular about a young woman who she was treating for juvenile arthritis. The woman was fine. Her parents lost her job. She had no health care, came back several years later, crippled for life in a wheelchair, simply because her parents lost their job and she didn't have health insurance. We're encouraged to see that DHS has set aside funds to continue Minnesota care. Moving this population into the exchange would move them backwards. How much this is going to cost depends on the feds, and we are working with DHS and the feds to try to see what we can do to help move that decision along. But we're pleased to see they have a commitment to continuing the Minnesota Care program. We also applaud Governor Dayton for proposing a renewed commitment to home and community-based services in his budget through Reform 2020. We think by providing more choices and helping people stay in their homes, Reform 2020 will save taxpayers about $151 million over 5 years. Like several other testifiers, I'm going to veer slightly afield of this committee and compliment the governor for his 94% tax increase in the budget. While we prefer revenue options that are more progressive, economic justice should take a backseat to health care justice. And just speaking from personal experience, having smoked 5 years in Georgia with the lowest cigarette tax rate in the country and 5 years here in Minnesota with a much higher tax rate, it was much easier to quit here in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. As part of the Raise It for Health Coalition, we encourage the legislature to look at $1.50 per pack, which would do much more to promote smoking cessation. It's a public health measure, and I think that's why this committee should be interested in it. Finally, we would like to thank Governor Dayton for including a modest increase in funding for Minnesota nursing homes. While we are still looking at the details, it seems that the governor provides a 2% annual increase in non-property rates, both as a fixed across-the-board increase and a variable quality bonus. We encourage the legislature to include language dedicating a portion of this increase towards frontline caregivers. Such language has been included in every non-property rate increase since the late 90s. While we appreciate the governor's proposal, we think a larger increase is needed to make up for years of neglect. SEIU, along with other long-term care work unions, senior groups, and the Long-Term Care Imperative, we'll be supporting a bill from our member, Representative Patty Fritz, to provide a 5% rate increase. Since the late 90s, every legislature has modified the governor's nursing home budget upwards. We encourage you to continue this honorable and bipartisan tradition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Varco. We'll move to
the next few are bunches, so I'm just going to have Ann Henry come up, and then we have a couple that fit well together after that. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at Legal Aid. We represent children and adults with long-term, very significant disabilities across our state. And first of all, I want to thank you all for asking deeper questions on the budget information. We really appreciate that. We appreciate the budget tracking sheet at this point. And I do have a request. Please post on your committee website or get DHS to post any detail that you get so members of the puzzled public can also get more information about the connections and interactions on the budget. We'd really appreciate it. We support many, many of the items in the governor's budget. In the interest of time, I'm just going to tick off about five and then go to four items of concern. The rate increases in basic care, including dental, mental health, medical transportation, rehabilitative therapies, very needed. We support the quality initiative to encourage best practice positive behavior supports rather than aversive practices of restraint and seclusion in home and community services. We have long worked to get the common entry point for vulnerable adult reports. We're very happy to see that. We support many of the mental health proposals, the school-linked mental health services, expansion of crisis services, among others. And finally, we are in strong support of the reform and modernization of personal care assistance services into a new program, which of course has a new acronym you will hear a lot about, Community First Services and Support, CFSS. And we will be working to assure that people who need this service, whether they have physical need for assistance or need for prompting and supervision, will have access to it. Now the items of concern. Community services, you've already heard from several testifiers, including Jody Harpstead yesterday from LSS, that community service providers face a 1.67% rate cut, and they don't have an increase. These are the folks that are doing the work to keep people out of institutions. These are the preferable services, and we need a strong and a workforce, really, that can earn a living doing these jobs. So this really needs to be given a lot more consideration. Secondly, We are in strong support of the expansion of Medicaid to 138% of the poverty level and the Minnesota Care Waiver proposal. We think this offers a really significant, unique opportunity for people with disabilities, especially younger people. And here's why. At this point, when you are graduating from school with a disability, you are most likely told that you have to go to the Social Security Administration and declare yourself totally and permanently disabled, not able to get a job anywhere in the national economy. At the same time, you've been preparing to work. It is a very, very discouraging process. And the reason that we send people that down that path is because the only way they could get the benefits set in healthcare that they needed due to their condition and avoid the pre-existing condition issues and so on would be to qualify for Medicaid. The only way to qualify for Medicaid as a young adult or an adult without children is to have a disability. So this offers an opportunity for people not to go down that path. It's tremendous. As long as we assure the benefits people need, such as personal care assistance services, are included in the expansion and Minnesota care populations. But the second point I have to make is to put on the list of work undone in the ACA. If you look at all the charts from DHS about where we are now with poverty levels, you will see persons with disabilities and seniors at the bottom. They are on DHS charts at 100% of the poverty level. Actually, about half of them are required to spend down to 75%. Of the poverty level. And we are now working very hard to assure that people live independently in the community. And they rent in the same market, they buy food at the same grocery stores. They need to be at 138% of the poverty level along with everyone else on Medicaid. The third issue is we're very happy about the governor's proposal for children with autism to add money and benefits in the Medicaid program. One area, though, that we think needs attention is better accountability from our managed care organizations who serve our immigrant communities and communities of color. We have to make sure, given the disparities that we have in Minnesota, that these communities are getting access to early intensive services. And fourth is the transition from Anoka and Security Hospital. We have clients in these situations. We support increased community funding for them, and we understand it's from an increased county share. It's important to remember that that county share is tagged to people who are ready to go at Security Hospital, and we're not sure of the language on Anoka, and perhaps that should be made clear. There is much a county can do, including starting discharge planning when they find that they have someone going to one of those places. But we also think DHS needs to make some changes. One of them would be to add a specific exception to the adult corporate foster care moratorium for people leaving, ready to go from Security Hospital in Anoka. And another would be to specifically inform each county with a person at Anoka or Security Hospital that they have a home and community-based waiver slot despite the waiting list. Those people do have priority in our state law because they're in an institution. That should be made very clear to the counties. Thank you.
Ms. Henry, thank you for the very helpful and detailed suggestions. Look forward to working together. Bruce Nelson, and I understand Lee Lewis down lower on the list could also fit well with this testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the division. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of about 140 to 150, depending upon the year, providers who support people with disabilities across the state of Minnesota in the CADI, TB or BI, DD, CAC waivers, as well as ICF's DD and other programs. Mr. Lewis is a member of ARM, does a lot of, well, he'll describe his programs, and that's very, very much needed, in customized living in particular. I want to talk about three things and their concerns. that we want to draw to your attention. The first is the budget has no increase, no rate increase, no COLA for disability providers for the next 2 years. This includes DT and Hs, and I think I can speak on their behalf about this concern as well. The budget does add funding for pay for performance in the 2 years from now. That would be fiscal years 16 and 17. And what this would be is a pool of money in a through a yet to be determined process, a quality determination process that would provide providers with varying amounts. And we, you know, depending upon what comes through. Well, we are absolutely willing to work and want to work with you, with the department, with families, people who receive services on how to define this. But at the same time, let me say this about quality care. Without a stable workforce, there is no policy that you can invent that will produce quality care for vulnerable people, period. And that goes back to the lack of funding for those people, our caregivers. This is a workforce that hasn't benefited from a COLA since the 2008 legislative session, during which times rates have actually gone down 4.1%. And our caregivers can't really wait another 2 years. They need to be acknowledged by you, and you historically have done that, and we trust you will again. The budget is inconsistent in that you've heard testimony. It does provide increases for in a number of areas and in some programs of for people doing precisely the same type of work but also vulnerable people of various sorts in nursing homes, fee-for-service providers. We were very pleased to see the increase for the ARMS program for people with mental illness. That was very much needed and appropriate. And another action that's moving through the legislature is a 2% increase for state caregivers and state-operated programs. They do the same work, take care of the same kind of people. And we think there is a real fairness issue out there when the private sector is not acknowledged. Try to remember this, too, as you're considering budget considerations. 97% of our funding comes from government, 97%, primarily through Medicaid. That means, unlike many other human services programs, we can't cost shift. We can't. There are no other revenue streams, and so we can't move things around. It is what it is. Number two, being overlooked is distressing enough. There's the 1.67 shift and cut that has been addressed by Ms. Henry and Mr. Larson. It takes a long time to describe it, but the essence is we start out the next biennium for the first 6 months in the hole with a 1.67 cut to our services. I'm delighted to say Senator Hoffman will be authoring a bill to address this. So, and thank you last year, Senator Brown and Senator Lurie for your leadership on getting that done. Finally, in the licensing area, the bill or the governor's budget adds about $3.2 million in licensing fees that it tries to expand licensing to currently unlicensed programs, and which is something we knew was coming and in theory is appropriate. We lower licensing standards on where we overdo it and raise it up where we underdo it. That's a good thing. But you got to remember that fee money, there's fees of about $3.2 million is not magic money. It comes out of the very same pool of money that goes to pay caregivers. So in essence, it is a cut. It's a reduction in services and care for people. So as you As you look at the licensing issue, I ask you to look for two things. What are we currently buying through fees in investigations and inspections? And I think we can explore different ways to do licensing, to do inspections, to do investigations, essentially how to pay for them. And we'd be willing to work on that. We very much admire the work of Mr. Kerber and work very well with him through to common cause. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the division, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Mr. Lewis, is that correct?
My name is Lee Lewis. I'm executive director of Clare Housing, which is the largest provider of housing for people living with HIV and AIDS in the state. We have three different programs. We are licensed. We have adult foster care homes that serve folks who would otherwise be in nursing homes. We have two single-site permanent supportive housing programs with a total of 72 individuals living in those. And then we have a scattered site program where we master lease apartments in the community and sublease them to families and individuals affected by HIV who've been homeless for a year or more. And I would basically like to just talk to two things. And one is the rates that are not set in the governor's budget. Bruce mentioned it's been an effective 10% cut over the last 5 years in our rates, and we use the community alternatives for disabled individuals. Inflation's been about 9%, and the rates have been basically zero. So that's an effective 10% cut for us. My program, due to legislation in 2011, saw a 6% cut. It was a targeted cut to people living in congregate settings on the waivered programs. Because of a flawed assessment, 60% of the people that live in our housing and receive services got that 10% cut. It's an effective 6% cut. So as a provider, I look at, in essence, over the last 5 years, 16% reduction, which I have to manage. We put in overnight monitoring electronically. We have changed staffing patterns. We have tried very hard, and we have had to close buildings, close programs. So I strongly urge that the 1.6% cut be removed, and I also strongly urge an increase, a cost of living increase, in the waivered services rates. That's number one. Number two, it's a little bit off this program, but I'm going to mention this committee's agenda, but I'm going to mention it anyways. Last year, there was a limitation put on how many, 25% of the individuals in a building can receive waivered services, no more than 25%. And what that effectively does is makes it impossible for my program, my organization, to replicate our permanent supportive housing. And the impact that has, when we opened our last permanent supportive housing, five people who lived in our foster homes moved into that permanent supportive housing on the community-based waivered programs, saving the state or saving at half the cost for services and living more independently with their own lease. So that limitation of 25%, however, makes it impossible for us to replicate it because and I won't go into the details, we were grandparented in. We won't have to close those two programs, but we won't be able to do it again. And that has significant, we can see significant savings for a certain population of folks who live in adult foster care by being able to do permanent supportive housing using home and community-based waivered services to provide supports. So I would recommend eliminating that restriction. Thank you for your time. And
Mr. Lewis, thank you very much for your testimony. And Mr. Nelson. Next, we're going to hear from Edward Eide with the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. And on the deck will be Mary Jo George and Amy McDonough. I do need to encourage people to stay within the 4 or 5 minute time limits. We are running slightly behind, but I think we will be okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Ed Eide. I'm the executive director of the Mental Health Association of Minnesota, and I will be brief. First of all, I want to support Ann Henry's comment about information. We had a meeting the other day with the commissioner and the assistant commissioners, and they walked through the fast facts forms, and it was confusing because there weren't a lot of words to look at the dollars that were there. So some of us are testifying with only a little bit of information, but it's good and it's scary. So while the budget overall keeps money for mental health services, the revenue neutrality appears to take funding away from some services and moves it to other services, but we can't be sure because we don't have all the information. What's a little frightening is we know that ARMS providers are closing their doors, and so we're moving money to provide more ARMS services, but we're afraid that money's going to come from counties and mental health initiatives. And that's where basic services for people with mental illnesses get their primary care. CSPs, drop-in centers, all those kinds of things. They get a little support if their car won't start, things like that. And so we're very afraid of what that might look like because we need those strong services in our communities. Commissioner Jessen spoke about two buckets in DHS. One is ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and the other is DHS. All the rest of DHS. While we support engaging in ACA, we support expansion of Minnesota Care also. You've heard that before. The groundbreaking innovation for people who fall through the cracks. Hopefully the federal government will support this and we can provide health care to more Minnesotans, and we're supposed to find out in February about that. That's a key. We like the expansion of school-linked mental health services and the expansion of crisis teams. We like the expansion of community supports and housing. I want to give you a little bit of an impact on what crisis teams mean in this state. In Becker County in 2011, 75 people were suggested to be committed. The crisis teams, or hospitalized, the crisis teams took that 75 and diverted 48 of them. 48 out of 75 were not hospitalized. That's a lot of money saved. And that only happens because the crisis teams know their community and know whatever. There's proposed expansion for that to 16 more counties and 2 tribes. That's exciting. I'd like to also speak about in Swift County. I was visiting Swift County this summer, and 2 years ago, an adult foster care provider was testifying before the House in this situation. And she was talking about the importance of those 4 beds in that community in Grove City. Now, if you've ever been through Grove City, well, you missed it. There's not much there, but this AFC was the primary employer in that city. She bought groceries at the grocery store, bought gas. So at the local advisory council in Benson, in Swift County, the provider and one of her residents were talking about what's going on there. These 4 women in this facility have lived together for 15 years. They are their own family. And the talk while I was there was about closing the doors. And where are these 4 women going to go? So the county is busting their butt, pardon me, to try to find somebody to take over that program. I haven't found out if they have yet or not, but hopefully. While we have some issues with the Olmstead plan as it relates to people with mental illnesses, the fact of the matter is there is no choice about keeping people out of institutions and helping them live well in the community. It's the right thing to do, and it saves money. Some of you recall a few years ago you directed state-operated services to move people out of AMRTC. We convened work groups and spent over 18 months determining what community services would look like. Currently, we have people in Anoka who have complex medical needs but do not need the medical necessity of care. This is costly and slows down the transition of others needing this level of care to obtain it. Now, in this budget is a plan for doing just that. We may be short on information at what it looks like, and we may not necessarily agree that state-operated services is the right provider. Many of us think that community providers would be better for those services, but it's something that's being proposed as a direct result of this committee. We need to make this plan work to take better care of people. It'll save money and move forward with appropriate treatment of mental illness. I'm certain that we will be having more discussions, and as the chairman said, in the next couple of months as more specifics and options are introduced. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Idy, thank you for your testimony. And, you know, to you and Ann Henry, as we get further details on the budget, we will make those as available as possible at all times, because it's important that we all understand and work together to get to the right place. Mary Jo George, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mary Jo George, Associate Director of Advocacy for AARP Minnesota, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Overall, AARP is very pleased with the governor's balanced approach to solving this state budget deficit and to the administration's commitment to fully implement opportunities to improve health care under the Affordable Care Act. We also are very supportive of the investments in nursing homes, along with the focus on the quality initiatives in both nursing facilities and community-based services. We'd like to echo what you've heard from others today, though, that it would be important to make these same investments in home and community-based services. Today, however, my comments will focus on the reform efforts in the continuing care area of the budget, and particularly our concerns around the new transition programs for seniors, including the new essential community support program. In general, AARP supports the goals of delivering services to individuals at the right time and at the right place. However, we continue to have serious concerns around the eligibility changes to the Medicaid programs and the loss of elderly waiver services for thousands of seniors beginning in 2014. We are particularly concerned that the largest group of individuals impacted are seniors living in the community today. As we continue to monitor the changes, we are concerned with the potential harm to vulnerable persons and the disruption of care as the department transitions these seniors into less robust and possibly inadequate programs. We strongly believe in order to mitigate these disruptions and avoid harm, there will need to be additional services and supports made available in this budget this year. I will try to be brief, but we have four concerns around the programs. The first is the Essential Community Support Program itself. While the department envisions that this $400 grant is for people who are not yet eligible for Medicaid, for seniors that are currently involved or enrolled in the Elderly Waiver Program, this is a significant cut not only in services but in the benefit design. So we really think we need to look at how much the department is paying for these seniors and how much they, in fact, are utilizing in services and what benefits. Second, we continue to have concerns around the potential loss of housing for some seniors. We wonder what will happen to seniors who may now have sold their home and moved into an assisted living facility. Neither the state plan Medicaid benefits nor the ECS program offer the 24-hour customized living service packages. We are concerned if the seniors are asked to move out of these facilities, there is not adequate community supports or transition plannings. It's very likely that these seniors could fall through the cracks and end up winding up in more costly nursing home placements. Third, we are very concerned with some of the with seniors with high medical needs who now will be required to spend thousands of dollars more in out-of-pocket costs to retain Medicaid, and this is because you have different financial standards between your waiver program and your state Medicaid program. Ann Henry alluded to this. We disagree with the department's assumption that these seniors will be able to continue living in the community given that they will only have about $8,000 a year annually to live on under this new program. Finally, for seniors who transition to Medicaid because their income is so low from the waiver program, we do not believe the benefits are a substitute in MA for the elderly waiver program, and they're certainly not as robust. So we are unclear at this point how the department plans to evaluate these changes. It is for these reasons we're urging lawmakers to work with us to find ways to mitigate the harm that could happen, and one of the ideas we have is to potentially grandfather these seniors in. Ironically, the department is doing this for seniors who have resided in nursing homes for at least 90 days. We believe if we do not apply the same standard to seniors living in the community, we are going to continue policies that potentially create an institutional bias and keep paying for services in costly institutions over community care. In conclusion, while we recognize the enormous budget challenges that are before you and the challenges of an aging population, we believe if we do not get it right, there is real potential for harm and costly institutionalizations. And I forgot to hand out my nifty chart, but this sort of outlines both the transition programs and some of the costs that we're paying today. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have that handed out, and members will have that available to them. With that, Carrie Thurlow and Toby Pearson, both on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. Testifying with our partners at Aging Services, together our advocacy is under the umbrella of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Minnesota's nursing homes and assisted living providers contribute over 112,000 jobs and over $6.7 billion to the state economy. On average, 65 to 70% of providers' budget go to wages, benefits, for their employees. Long-term care services are an economic engine in many of your communities. Our membership's reaction to the governor's proposed funding increase for skilled nursing facilities is mixed. We'd like to thank the governor for acknowledging us in his budget. That's for the first time in approximately 10 years that nursing homes have been included. However, we do need to clarify that this proposal is budget neutral. There was an increase to property and operating rates that was delayed or shifted to pay for this increase. We'd like to state also that we have some concerns regarding the increase being tied to current quality measures. We feel strongly that we need to craft a quality or performance measure that does not punish providers with a backward-looking report card approach, but instead we would like to see an approach that will incent people to improve from where they are today. This is an approach that serves as a carrot to providers for taking positive and proactive steps towards improvement. We need to seriously examine the overall funding and how much of that increase should be base increases and how much should be in relationship to improvement increases. As one of our members said to us, a 1% increase with another 1% tied to quality does not begin to cover the Medicaid gap between allowable charges and costs, which is now over $27 per day. And there is no plan to try to close that gap. To put the proposal in perspective, we have reports that average hourly wage paid to a nursing assistant can be around $11 an hour. This, as one of our members said, this increase of 12 cents per hour does next to nothing in real terms to their standard of living or our ability to compete as an employer. We hear reports of turnover rates exceeding 50%. We hear reports of massive staff loss when a new Menards opens up. The turnover and loss of staff impacts the seniors who are receiving the services. We also hear reports of suspended admissions because nursing homes simply do not have the staff and cannot hire the staff to care for these seniors. With the economic times that we have lived through since 2008 and large state budget deficits, we recognize that legislators have a big challenge. But you need to know that you have an enormous amount of control over the financial stability of Minnesota's nursing homes. 82% of the money coming into a nursing home is controlled by the Medicaid rate. Their needs have been ignored far too long. Investments in senior services are investments in caregivers and the seniors they serve.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota, and with Mr. Pearson, we are, appearing here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'm going to focus my comments, since Mr. Pearson covered sort of the nursing home side of things, I'm going to focus my comments on the Elderly Waiver Program and the governor's proposals related to that program. And I know you've heard a lot of testimony today about a lot of different issues, so I'm just going to cut to the chase and let you know that what I hope you take away from this testimony today and what you'll hear us talking about kind of throughout session is that a budget that supports nursing homes, and while nursing homes are very important, and funding for nursing homes is very needed, you do not have a budget that supports seniors if you do not also support the Elderly Waiver Program. The Elderly Waiver Program funds home and community-based services for people over the age of 65 who are eligible for medical assistance, who qualify for nursing facility level of care, but have chosen to receive their services outside the nursing home. This could be in home care situations, or this could be in an assisted living or housing with services type setting. This has been an extremely important program to Minnesota seniors. It has been nation-leading. Many states are looking to us as this program has been extremely valuable, as it's provided a variety of care options and opened up access to a variety of options for seniors. It has helped support seniors in where they want to receive care, but also notable for budget discussions, it's extremely cost-effective. For individuals on the Elderly Waiver Program, we can serve about 3 seniors on the Elderly Waiver Program for every 1 senior in a nursing home. It's also a growing program, as we have shifted, and intentionally so, towards serving more individuals in home and community-based services. We are now serving over 22,000 seniors on the Elderly Waiver Program. And that caseload far exceeds those that we serve in nursing homes. Again, I want to highlight that there is always an important role for nursing homes. But as we prepare for the age wave, and we are just a few years away from the senior population exceeding the school-age children population, we need to make sure that we are supporting these cost-effective and important programs. Unfortunately, Governor Dayton's program, our budget proposal, does not include any base increases to these programs. And when you take that in context, especially for the Elderly Waiver Program, paying for customized living services, those are services in assisted living or housing with services settings, that program has taken double-digit cuts over the last 4 years, impacting access to those services and impacting the workers that provide those services. Moreover, as you've heard from many others today, the governor's budget does not address the rate cut that is currently on the books, set to take effect on July 1st of this year, of an additional 1.67%. And that will be on top of the double-digit cuts that this program has taken over the last 4 years. I asked one of our members in Elk River what the impact of the elderly waiver cuts over the last 4 years has been on her residents and her staff. And she said she chose to name this resident, Resident M, in the name of privacy. But she said, Resident M has been living in our assisted living establishment for 5 years. She is aging in place, which we all strive to do. And as she ages, her care needs are increasing. They're becoming more complex, which require more staff time to complete medication administration for personal cares. And yet her rate, as her needs increase, arguably her elderly waiver budget should increase, but it has actually gone down over the last 4 years. Now, this provider is mission-driven and is doing everything she can do to keep that client in her establishment. But the question is, what would you do if you were faced with declining budgets, looking at another rate cut again this year, with no hope of increases over the next 2 years? What would you do? And it's becoming a tough question for a lot of our providers out there. The governor does propose a small PIP-like program, a performance payment program, for all home and community-based services for this biennium. And while we do applaud efforts to encourage innovation and quality improvement in home and community-based services, simply put, $6.6 million spread across all waiver programs is not enough to make a meaningful difference and sort of move the dial, and does not make up for the cuts to these programs. The governor's budget also proposes that in the out years, the next biennium, that we establish a report card for all home and community-based services to establish a pay-for-performance system in the future. And I want to echo Mr. Pearson's comments with regard to pay-for-performance. We support the concept, but again, we want to strive for measures that are forward-looking to incentivize paying for performance and quality rather than a backward-looking approach. We don't know what this report card would look like. It still has not been developed. So our providers, in dealing with rate cuts and rate freezes over the past several years, will have little ability to sort of change operations to earn that performance measure in just 2 short years' time. And so we have some concerns, especially doing this in a currently underfunded system. Seniors and caregivers need to be a top priority this session. It's the bottom line. As I said, soon the senior population will exceed the school children population. And again, we look forward to conversations with this committee, with the administration, in discovering a complete budget solution to making sure that that happens. And thank you for the time, and we look forward to future conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson and Ms. Thurlow. If testifiers will work with me here, in order to manage time a little bit better, I'm going to ask folks to start coming up together in groups of three, and I'm trying to group them together. Health Partners is next on the list, but I'm going to try to put Shantara Hardy and Lynn Nelson with Blue Cross Blue Shield and Robert Freeman also with Health Partners, but speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'm going to try to group the three of you, but I know Robert Freeman was out, so I was going to take you next and give you a minute to group and organize yourselves. So, I mean, if I was going to take Jennifer Sorensen with the Home Care Association and Tim Burkett with People Inc. To come up next, and maybe ask Ron Brandt also to join if you three can come up together and work with the committee, that would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Sorensen, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Home Care Association. I'm here to speak on behalf of my members. I have over 200 members that are home care providers within the state of Minnesota. They include freestanding individual agencies, home care agencies out in rural Minnesota to the urban areas, to transitional care facilities that provide all levels of care to hospital-based home care agencies and hospice entities. As you can see, there's been several themes throughout the day, and I think you'll see that the themes will continue. We are very much in support of several pieces of the governor's budget. One being we feel that we are very much in support and happy to see the increased access to healthcare across Minnesota through the Affordable Care Act and those increases. We also feel that the Reform 2020 efforts that are looking at home and community-based services, medical assistance services, and those processes to be a very positive and beneficial move. Reform in some of those areas has been much needed over the long haul, and it's very nice to see a lot of that come to fruition. We're also very much in support of the expansion of the mental health services through new funding through the mental health services component of the governor's budget. We also are happy to hear the address of the fraud, waste, and abuse, and some of the program integrity issues that are coming forward. We as home care providers know that there are issues within the industry. We also know that they're very small and very isolated components, but definitely things that we as a home care entity support, and we just definitely believe in the integrity of the system. As you know, there are also other pieces of the budget that we do have some concerns, and we'd like you to be aware as a committee moving forward through your budgeting process. One being the issue in regards to rate cuts. There has yet to be a COLA increase, as some of our other testifiers have testified earlier. The fact that is not in the biennium budget is of a large concern to the home care industry. And again, it's are inclusive of a 1.67% rate cut coming to us in July 1, plus the 1 month payment shift, all of which were progressive efforts from the last legislative session to push off. The concern that my members have faced to me is they are looking at having to close their doors. What I can tell you emphatically that is happening across the state is we are seeing home care agencies having to shut their doors because of the cuts and the overhead burdens that are currently taking place. We're also looking at uncertainty with the Affordable Care Act. As the Affordable Care Act moves forward, there's employer mandates that are inclusive within that, that when we're looking at absolutely no budget margins for revenues and then having to supply other costly services and components to employees, again, those become very hard budget decisions for home care agencies, and they've really become very creative in what they can do with less. And as you, as stated with previous testimony, we have received cut after cut and absolutely no increase or reestablishment of our rates as healthcare costs go up. So with all of those pieces in play, you know, we're hoping that through the process of the Reform 2020 that the department allows for increased stakeholder input into the process of the Community First Supports and Services programming. There is a PCA program unwinding with that program that I think you all should be aware of. Which does have some of the program integrity issues attached to that. There is a lot of intricacies to that program that have yet to be addressed, and we are very concerned about that unfolding. And so we want to make sure that the program becomes very successful, and we are very much in support of the change of the program, but there is a current, very cumbersome, very administrative burdened program that is in place that will need to be addressed through that process. So we ask that you're mindful of that. We also look at the process of the legislation regarding licensing of providers. The department is also doing that, but we are also seeing that a crosswalk with that happening in the health department world as well, which dramatically impacts the home care industry, because when we're looking at two sets of licensing components and regulations and regulatory burdens, we ask that there's a crosswalk that takes place between those two through that process. And with that, you know, at the end of the day, what I can tell you is my members want to provide care. They want to provide care in the home. Individuals want to age in place, and home care is the answer, both statewide and nationally. But yet we have yet to see any support to the home care industry. We've seen it in the hospital industry. We've seen it in the physicians industry. We've seen it in the specialist industry, but yet to see the support financially to be able to increase the access and the services to people who are wanting to stay in their homes and staying out of costly institutions. So I thank you for your time.
Ms. Arnson, thank you for your testimony. Ron, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the division, I'm Ron Brand, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. Our members provide services for around 130,000 people in Minnesota and have 127 different facilities or clinics or sites around the state. So they're scattered in most every region of the state. What's somewhat unusual about our member organizations is they provide a mixture of outpatient clinical psychiatric services, rehabilitative services, case management services, kind of a continuum of community-based services that specialize in serving people with serious mental illness or emotional disturbance and addictions. Half of our members are licensed as chemical dependency providers. Half of them provide various types of residential services that you've heard about here today. And most all of them provide both child and adult services. They work closely with counties and other community providers, and they're key providers for health plans, public and private. But they're, at the core, a safety net provider, because they provide well over half of their services are provided to people who are on Medicaid, and they provide services for a substantial number of people who are uninsured. Because of the way they are so comprehensive, many of the budget items that are in the, that we see today are intersect in the areas that our providers do work with. They work with waiver services. They have physicians on the staff. They employ about 80 psychiatrists. They provide a range of things. And it's like a stool, a three-legged stool for mental health. Is you often have this combination of the professional clinical treatments that by psychiatrists or physicians, the therapies and rehabilitative services that people will need, and the medications that people will want. And you need to have those all working together, and if one of them falls off, those supports or the therapies or the medications, the whole thing starts to tip. And so we really appreciate that the approach in the governor's budget is quite comprehensive, and there are a number of budget areas that are that speak to mental health. And we also have noticed, as people have testified, that there have been expressions of support for mental health services. It's an area where there's been some deferred maintenance or some deferred effort, I think, over the past several years. So I'm going to go through just several different budget items and real quickly here. But in the area of expanded Medicaid, I think that will improve access to earlier services, helping people, adults, to avoid a downward decline into disability. It's a solid foundation that will provide some security for people, and I think will help us have a system that's less focused on responding in a crisis or emergencies. There are rate increases for targeted services, which would include mental health services, and we're glad to see that there. I think it'll help. There's a program for crisis diversion and discharge planning, which is part of Reform 2020, that will help reduce some avoidable costs. But it needs to be coordinated with some other things that we have within the mental health system of crisis services, as you heard talked about, and some of the in-reach coordination with hospitals. There's a work empowerment or encouraging independence that it builds on an effective program that has demonstrated results, but it really doesn't help develop or support a personal placement of the evidence-based practice, which is more hands-on and face-to-face and supporting people in their work placements. There's transition initiatives to help reduce extended reliance on institutional care by helping to transfer complex and challenging people from the hospital to nursing care to intensive residential treatment or alternative community-based care. That's a really good idea. We need to learn more about the details. I mean, these things are funded. Many of the items here are funded by changing, reducing grants or other line items in order to create a new benefit or to add some new services. The School Link grants are significantly increased, and we're delighted to see this. And we know that our members provide most of these services, and we know they've been very effective in their co-located services, that linking the providers with the schools and helping to identify problems early before they overwhelm both the family and the school's resources. There's a new clinical care coordination benefit that helps fill gaps between services to help have better coordinated care. But that's also funded by reducing another grant in order to make a new benefit. There's a family psychoeducation benefit, which is a very great idea and good, and we would strongly support it. As Ed Idy mentioned, there are some crisis response services to try to bring up those services in other counties in the state, and that really takes pressure off the police and the emergency rooms, and we can, working together with the other services, they help turn people around and avoid hospitalizations and other costs. The adult mental health rehabilitative services are called ARMS, is an area that where providers have been dropping out of those, and they've been losing their footing for the past several years for a variety of reasons, and there's a proposal to shift some dollars again to try to refinance that and stabilize those programs, and it's very, very important to us. There's a couple things that are missing that we would like to have seen. Wish there was some support for health information technology. Our providers are safety net providers. They don't have, like, big budget reserves. We're not the Allina Health System or the Fairview Health System or the Mayo. But developing the ability, the capacity to be able to share information with other providers that we are serving, our people are often connected to multiple health systems, and we're not going to borrow any one of them, but we need to have the ability to share with multiple physician groups or primary care clinics, hospitals, and others. And we would have liked to have seen a proposal to help develop our community mental health providers to develop the capacity to create a customized health home that could bring together many of these services, like we have talked about with health homes, but to specialize in treating people with more serious and complex mental health and primary care problems. People with mental illness often are, they die at the age of around, on average, around, with serious mental illness, around 54 years old. And that's something we can do something about. And this is an approach that we think will be effective, and we would love to see some development of that service and to help our providers make those transitions. You know, there's been increasing interest in mental health services following the massacre in Sandy Hook and some of the discussions about trying to prevent gun violence. And I know that we've had lots of thoughts and lots of plans that have gone into thinking about how to better improve our services. And we know that we can do better, and we know that we can help manage the total cost of care without cost shifting, without moving people around like a hot potato. And we look forward to working with you in the days ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. And now, you don't look much like the Tim Burkett I know, but
you know, I'm not.
I'm guessing you are still from People, Inc.
I am from People, Inc. My name is Bill Gray. Chairman Laurie, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gray, and I'm with People Incorporated Mental Health Services. We're the largest provider of services to people living with mental illness in the state. Our CEO, Dr. Tim Burkett, had planned to be here this morning, but he's ill, and he's asked me to testify in his place. So my testimony will be brief and will focus on the critical importance of the two items that we're most pleased to see in the governor's budget, mental health crisis services and school-linked mental health. As mental health professionals, we know that early intervention is the key to living successfully with a mental illness. Clinical research clearly demonstrates better outcomes for people who have had shorter periods of untreated psychosis, and we see its positive effect every day in our work. Therefore, addressing mental illness symptoms in the school setting as soon as they present is the best way to prevent future problems. School offers kids the first social interaction that they must navigate completely on their own. And having mental health professionals in the school allows them to work directly with teachers and see the kids up close in these everyday interactions. In-school mental health programs teach coping skills for depression and anxiety that can work over the long term and help facilitate successful learning in the classroom and a successful lifetime in the community. We applaud the governor for proposing a doubling of funding for school-linked mental health programs, and we urge you and your colleagues to support this proposal as well. More specific to the jurisdiction of this committee is the proposal on mental health crisis services. For adults experiencing a mental health crisis due to significant life stressors, crisis residences and mobile crisis teams provide short-term mental health stabilization services, again, early on in the process. These venues are an inexpensive, humane alternative to hospital locked wards when appropriate, and they save a tremendous amount of money. If you look at the handout I've provided, it's the legal size. The graph on the far right illustrates People Incorporated's experience in treating 1,500 individuals for severe depression in a crisis venue. In just 1 year, this service saved approximately $19 million compared to the cost that would have been incurred for the similar treatment in a hospital setting. We applaud the governor for proposing the expansion of mobile health crisis teams outstate, and we urge the committee to support this proposal as well. The remaining two graphs on the handout illustrate People Incorporated's experience in treating other populations with mental illness. Those with a severe and persistent illness requiring housing with services, and those who are homeless. So just a quick look at this. The graph on the left deals with our residential programs. We serve more than 100 Twin Cities residents each year with this service. Since 2009, we've helped just two of these individuals avoid hospitalization for depression 57 separate times. And you can see the chart there. That's a savings of more than $615,000. And how do we do that? They're in a venue where they have access to the therapy and the backup support and the services that they need to keep them stable. So you can see over the 4 years there, the hospitalization avoided as the green, and that goes down at the top there. Hospitalizations themselves reduced to zero for these two people. Finally, the chart in the middle deals with our homeless outreach. Our homeless outreach serves more than 600 people every year, and this is so important in decreasing rates of arrest and incarceration, hospitalization, shelter use. The math that we did shows that for these 600 people, for our work with them in 1 year, it saved and provided a return on the investment of $230,000 per year. But look at the chart, and you can see that homeless nights for these people in one of our programs decreased from 75 a night before they got into this is the Housing First program. Before they got into that program, they had an average of 75 homeless nights a year. A year later, they had 4 or 5. 72% decrease. So this stuff works, and it works for those we serve, for taxpayers, and for the community. We'd urge you to look into this further as you search for ways to reduce costs and increase efficiency over the next 2 years. And of course, we'd welcome the opportunity to discuss any of this data with you in greater detail. Thank you all again for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions now or later at your convenience.
Mr. Gray, mm-hmm. Ron Brandt, Sorensen, thank you for your testimony. Wish Mr. Burkett a fast recovery on our behalf. Thank
Absolutely.
You for your testimony.
Thank you.
I think that I did see Robert Freeman join us, so if we could bring Robert Freeman, Shantara Hardy, and Lynn Nelson up, and I don't mean to bunch you all together all the time. I know you're separate entities, but welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Let me go first. I'm clear. I'll go first. My name is Lynn Nelson. I'm from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, and I'm here to support the governor's proposal on the tobacco tax increase. I'll be very brief. Tobacco tax is good. Increasing it is very good. It's the single most effective way to stop kids from starting. In addition, in 2010, commissioned a study, and it showed that we had $3 billion in excess health care costs in Minnesota due to smoking-related diseases. So we very strongly support the increase in the tobacco tax by the governor. We think it's within this committee's purview to look at that, and we would encourage even maybe a higher rate, up to $1.50 would be a good rate to go with. Blue Cross has long been committed to reducing tobacco use in Minnesota, and we would be we would provide any information that you would like to support your cause and encourage you to support the tobacco tax increase. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Shantara Hardy, and I'm the Government Relations Manager at Health Partners. I thank you for the opportunity to testify on the governor's budget. Quickly, as you know, Health Partners is an integrated healthcare company with over 20,000 employees in Minnesota. We are a health plan, we are clinics, and we are hospitals. We're devoted to our mission of improving the health of our members, patients, and the community. And because of our role as both payer and provider, we have a very unique perspective on the budget. There are several funding provisions that Health Partners strongly supports and a couple that are of concern. Very quickly, with respect to some of the areas that were mentioned by Mary Krinke, we are in strong support of the expansion of Medicaid. We believe this will be good for access and also reducing uncompensated care. For our hospital, Regents Hospital, with charity care costs at $20 million last year, we believe coverage is very important to reducing those costs. Please know that we do want to sound some cautions. The expansion is certainly not a silver bullet. Coverage does not guarantee access at 100%, especially when provider rates are not as high in the Medicaid program. We also want to make sure that we are working to improve the care that we provide in the program, and we're committed to doing that with improved care coordination. The other area that we are strongly supportive of is the restoration of the MERC funding. As a level one adult and pediatric trauma and teaching hospital, we think it's very critical to make sure that we have the funding to train our practitioners for the future, both in primary care and specialty care. We understand that the department will be working on a new formula. We're hoping to be at that table. We know there is a strong interest in primary care, but as a trauma hospital, we know that we have to make sure that we have the supply of specialists in order to make sure we can provide that specialized care. The other area that I really want to talk about that we have mixed emotions on is the Emergency Medical Assistance Program. We are very grateful for the restoration of the care for cancer and dialysis. However, we really believe there needs to be a comprehensive fix to this program. Totally understand the federal guidelines of making sure that it is paid for emergency care, but we are experiencing issues where we are getting individuals in the hospital, the emergency care is paid for, and we can't discharge because there is no place for them to go. And so we really are hoping that we can work with DHS to reform this program for this population, but also not to forget those 240,000 individuals that will not have coverage after 2014. And the state hopefully will have a structure in place for that population. Quickly, we are supportive of the increases in the provider rates. I will point out very, very important, the mental health rate increases. As the number one provider of mental health care in the East Metro, we really believe that sustainable investments in mental health care is much, much needed, especially in the areas of community services and also just making sure, which is related to the Merck investments, that we have the practitioners there to provide the services. The other area that I want to mention that we are still trying to get more information on, but the 340B program, as Mary mentioned, which is a federal program that provides reimbursements to hospitals that serve a disproportionate share of individuals on Medicaid, reimbursements for pharmacy. This program, from what our conversations were with DHS, would probably impact regions about $150,000 a year. Over the years, we've been using the rebates from this program to expand access, but also to provide individuals who are uninsured and underinsured prescriptions if they can't pay for them. One other area that we were able to do that I think is very critical is to open up our pharmacy past 1 o'clock in the morning so that people can have access to drugs. We believe it's best practice to send patients home with medications at the start of their healing process versus having them wait to come back for prescriptions. And so we're hoping to get more information on the department. We're hoping that this is just not a shift of money, that if there are reforms that are needed, that we do not get in the way of access for patients. Just lastly, to go on the record, we are supportive of the tobacco tax increase. We think this is one of the most effective ways to encourage tobacco users to quit. We are strongly interested in making sure that a lens with respect to disparities are a part of this conversation because those are the communities that are impacted most. We are strongly in support of the SHIP program to encourage investments in obesity and also in less tobacco use. Finally, I just want to just ask, as you deliberate this budget, we hope that you keep achieving the triple aim, which is improving health and quality and affordability in front of you. We know that the current budget shortfall means that we all need to play our part. Health Partners is committed to doing that. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hardy. Mr. Freeman? And we have several testifiers yet to go, so we're going to have to try to get it to three minutes.
I'll be as brief as I can.
All right,
thank you.
I
apologize that I was delayed, but I was testifying on another of the
chairs.
I was supporting your bill in the Senate, Mr. Chairman, so I hope I can be indulged. Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning, and thank you for allowing me to speak to the governor's budget proposal for the next biennium. For the record, my name is Robert Freeman, but I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. During the last several budget cycles, nearly all of the real cuts in the state budget came from HHS, in both cuts to eligibility and cuts in payment to health plans and providers. Appreciate the work that many of you on this committee have done to resist those cuts and reform our programs to keep the impact of those cuts as minimal as possible for those served. Now, 2 years later, a budget is proposed with $2 billion in new revenue, and yet the only new money that we see coming into the HHS budget is the federal Medicaid expansion dollars. An HHS budget without cuts is a welcome surprise for the HHS community, but we still feel there's an imbalance between HHS and other areas of the budget when it comes to the use of new revenues. This is concerning because the HHS budget has been most heavily impacted during these years. If additional revenue will be generated for the state, we would hope that new revenues will be divided among areas of the budget proportionately to the level of cuts that they've taken over the last few years. Another thing we'd like to highlight is that under this budget proposal, the health plan industry is contributing $50 million of savings in the next biennium, partly because of the value that managed care has brought to Minnesota in holding down costs. We'd like to note also the governor's recommendation to provide $12 million in funding for autism coverage. There were many questions raised by the Health Services Advisory Council about these services and the evidence behind them, and a healthy debate is still going on regarding this proposal. We're waiting to see further detail on this coverage provision, like a lot of you, specifically what population would be covered, whether coverage would be applied to all Medicaid recipients at all income levels and all ages, how providers will be credentialed, how services will be approved. And behind those questions is a concern that if this process is not managed carefully, there will be a great potential for costs to exceed estimates. I'd also reiterate that we're very pleased on behalf of the Council to see the inclusion of the tobacco tax increase into the Governor's budget recommendations. And finally, that we support the Governor's recommendation to expand the state's medical assistance program to cover single childless adults up to 138% of the federal poverty level. We also support the recommendations to preserve and improve Minnesota care with the use of federal dollars. We look forward to continuing to work with the Chairman and the committee members as the budget discussions continue, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Council of Health Plans.
Mr. Freeman, thank you. We have four more people. We're going to call them up in groups of two, Laura Kramer with the Dental Association and Dan Zimmer with Region 10 Quality Assurance. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members.
And stick to 3 minutes, it would really help us get through this.
Absolutely. I'll
greatly
be brief.
Appreciate it.
You've hung through a lot of testimony today. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Dental Association, and I'm here on behalf of them and our 3,500 members. I want to thank the governor and the commissioner and DHS for their recommendation to increase the reimbursement for both managed care and fee-for-service dental rates. This is a really great first step. It acknowledges that there are a lot of existing problems within the oral health program, especially with the deficit. However, we really believe that more must be done to provide access to the Minnesotans who need quality dental care. Across the state, we see issues with patients getting the dental care that they deserve and that they need. And as we look at the increasing number of people coming on to medical assistance, we're also concerned that we have a provider network that can sustain these patients. And our network is in jeopardy because the system's broken. We hear about the rates a lot. In dentistry, the rates haven't been increased for 14 years. We are one of the worst in the country for those rates. And those rates don't even cover half the costs on most of the dental services. And we really see that as a direct impact on a provider's ability to take care of those patients because so many dentists, about 75%, are solo and small practice providers. So we really feel like we're at a breaking point. We've dealt with cuts a lot over the years, as many of the provider groups have, but we've seen a lot of communities lose their dentists, especially over the last several years. Clinics are closing. New dentists can't come into the system because banks don't want to loan them money to see medical assistance patients. We take, for example, southern Minnesota. There's patients in Blooming Prairie and Faribault that are having to go to Rochester, some even up to the Twin Cities metro area, because they can't find a dentist. But the dentists care, and we do want to work with the state to continue to build this program. These rates need to be increased. We urge the department to look at incorporating savings from dental-related ER visits and trying to put the money into the fee schedule that delivers the care at the right time and at the right place. Dentistry is a really great prevention model, and if we can get that care done at the right time, then we can avoid downstream costs. In addition, we'd like DHS to take a closer look at the PMAP outcomes and hold them accountable to see those PMAP patients and how many of them really are getting the prevention and the dental access that's been promised to them. We have reason to believe that the current reimbursement rates create a problem both in the fee-for-service and then also on the managed care side as well. We have a really good second step coming, and that's that the legislative auditor has spent the summer doing a program evaluation for the dental reimbursement rates, and that report is expected to be released in the next couple of weeks. It's looking exactly at those rates, how it impacts a provider's ability to be in the medical assistance network, and how that then affects the patient access as well. We look forward to working with you as that report comes out and as we take additional looks into the governor's budget. Again, we're very grateful for the recognition and the ability to have this dialogue, but we do think that more needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Zimmer.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to briefly talk to you today. I am Dan Zimmer. I direct Region 10, Minnesota Region 10 Quality Assurance. For over 15 years, our organization has provided in southeastern Minnesota an alternative community regional approach to quality improvement, quality assurance, and licensing for services for people with disabilities. We utilize a tool called VOICE. Over the years, we've worked to share our system with other parts of the state, and we've taken steps forward, we've taken steps back. And in the last couple of years, we've really felt that we've been taking major steps forward with Department of Human Services. As Steve Larson mentioned, there's a DHS State Quality Council now that is looking at our monitoring system and looking at how to best provide licensing and monitoring for quality improvements. And we've been working with that council. We're very happy to hear that the governor's budget includes continued funding for this council, because they've been working since March of 2012, and already they've contributed so much. As Steve Larson from ARC Minnesota mentioned, they are reviewing a report tomorrow that hopefully will be in your hands soon. And I urge you to read that report and consider, is this the path that our state should go forward with in monitoring services for people with disabilities? We're poised to help with this progress. We want to share our experiences. We want to share the value that we bring as a regional approach. And one of the things that this council is recommending that a development of regional councils. So it was disheartening to see that funding for regional councils, specifically Minnesota Region 10, was not included in the governor's budget. I'm hoping that we'll be able to rectify that through this session so that we'll be able to help as we move forward with this system. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer. Rick Hammergren, with the DTNH providers, and then Tom Evanstadt. I don't see him in here any longer, but I think he's still around. We skipped him earlier. And Chris Jacobs, if folks were wondering, with Jobs Now, got ill as well. People are falling ill, but welcome to the committee, Mr. Hammergren.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rick Hammergren. I'm Senior Director for Training and Rehabilitation Services with Opportunity Partners. We're located in Minnetonka. We provide services to about 1,600 people with disabilities across the Twin Cities metro area annually. I'm speaking this morning representing MOR, the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation. This is a newly constituted organization, which is a merger of Macro 21 and the former Minnesota Habilitation Coalition. So we're trying to become more efficient in our work. MOR is comprised of 49 organizations throughout the state, providing services to more than 20,000 Minnesotans who have disabilities. I'd like to address several points and observations regarding Governor Dayton's proposed budget, and I promise less than three. MOR member agencies were astounded that our organizations were not recommended for a rate increase in this budget. It's been several years since direct support professional staff have been recognized for their hard work with a statewide COLA. Direct support professionals are the backbone of services for people who have disabilities. They are the personal care providers. They are the work skill instructors, the job coaches, and they have been waiting a long time for a raise. In fact, in the last session, home and community-based waiver provider rates were cut. 1.5% for residential services and 1% for HAB services like the one that I work in. And we also saw flat referrals and funding for vocational services remaining essentially flat. Other public and private sector employees have been enjoying continuing COLA payment or pay adjustments. And while we do not dispute the validity of those adjustments, we are asking for equity throughout the system. The hardworking direct support workforce desperately needs a raise, and providers need a COLA this session to make that happen. Many more member agencies also face the additional rate cut, as you've heard earlier, about the 1.67%. I'm not going to go into that in any greater detail, but emphasizing my first point, if we can make that happen, we can provide raises for direct support professionals. Just this week, more members learned some specific information regarding increases in licensing fees that our organizations will be subject to beginning in January of 2014. And that's with the promulgation of DHS Rule 245D. This will result in radical growth in state spending as the licensing department grows and enrolls more providers, and will also significantly expand medical assistance spending. While providers are hit with double or even triple licensing fees, at the same time that we face this July rate cut, and we have no COLA to provide any kind of salary relief. You're hearing a trend in my remarks that provider agencies are hurting. Turnover rates for DSPs are growing again, and expenses keep going up. We need relief, we need equity, and we need some help from this committee, frankly, to get this right, because we're not getting any consideration in the governor's proposed budget. While we're concerned or even alarmed by some of the omissions in the budget, more member agencies are ever hopeful. We're intentional and supportive of changes that will move the system in a direction more responsive to the people that we serve. We are encouraged by the governor's support for the DHS Reform 2020 innovations, and we support provisions to put people in a position to make their own choices and to take control of their funding and self-direction in community-based living and supports. Finally, more member agencies are also committed to our collaborative work with DHS in support of improving quality outcomes for the people who we serve. We encourage your committee to work closely with us as you consider implementation of MIN choices, provider enrollment, and rate-setting methodology. We want to continue as a partner with the legislature at DHS to create innovative solutions that will be successful and drive quality for people served. Thanks for your consideration.
Mr. Hammergren, thank you for your testimony. I see Tom Evanstead has made it. Mr. Evanstead, come forward. State your name for the record. I need to let you know we do have session at 11 o'clock. When we got to you in the hearing earlier, I did let members know that we copied your testimony and made it available to them. So as brief as you can be would be very helpful, and apologies that we're running short on time.
Excellent. Thank you, Senator Lurie. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the public, and any MSOP committees that might be watching. My name is Thomas Evanstead, and I make my public comments relating to the financial aspects for our state and for all of us within the state who will be affected by the controversial, difficult decisions that you have to make with regard to the MSOP. I also wish to note that I am concerned about the impact those decisions will have on our state's most vulnerable, non-criminal, non-sex offender citizens. These are the Minnesota citizens that my conscience dictates me to present this information for. As everybody is pretty much aware, the state has had a task force set up by the United States Federal Court District of Minnesota to address constitutional issues and some other aspects of the program. Some of the questions I want to pose briefly, and I'm sensitive to the time. One, why does Minnesota have more civilly committed sex offenders than any state of the 20? And these astronomically expensive SVP laws, we have more bodies in Minnesota in the MSOP by far than huge, heavily populated states like California, New York, Texas, with five times our population. And yet Minnesota has one of the lowest recidivism rates in the world with their ISR and with their sex offender treatment programming that they have within the Minnesota Department of Corrections. They have a program that works inside the DOC. It's called SOTP, and they do a great job. Steve Hewitt, a lot of those folks at DOC, Tom Roy. How and why does Minnesota catch them on the back end, as one of the judges even mentioned at the task force meeting? The concept of this is that you commit these men under the illusory pretext that they're going to get a short prison term imposed at a plea bargain type of a thing, and then the men think that they're going to go home rather than do a far worse fate than any life sentence that's ever been handed down since 1876 with the Younger brothers in the Stillwater State Prison. So the point would be that they don't go home. They tell them, we're going to give you 3 years. By the state statutes, you do 2 on 3. You think you're going home in 2 years. Well, in 2 years, then a week before you go home, you get called into your case manager, and you're not going home. You're never going home. Now, why are there so many sex offenders in Minnesota anyway? I've heard it asked at a task force meeting. Is it the water? What's different from here than Wisconsin? And what I can tell you is different than most any state in the whole country is there is no evidence required whatsoever in our sex statutes from A to Z. There's less evidence required right now to put a man away for 25 years or a life sentence on a first offense and some sex allegation than there is required for a petty misdemeanor. And I urge this committee to get with the people with the Judiciary Committee. I'll do what I can on that as well and try to plug that gap. That's why there's so many sex offenders, because you don't need any evidence and it's easy to point a finger and it's extremely difficult to defend yourself. I'm living proof of that. Why? This is critical. MSOP client Brad Stevens was sentenced to 3 years back in 2002. That meant due 2 on 3, he gets out in 2004. He's still in there. Why are only 72%? It's come out in the news recently. Only 72% of the men in the MSOP are level 3. So what that would indicate is that there are 28% of these people that are not level 3, which is high risk. And so what that means is when you have 28% of almost 700 people that are not the highest risk, worst of the worst, that the fear and the hype has been fed for 20 years, it's just not true. I've been in there. I lived in there for a year. When you have the level 1 and the level 2, the moderate and low risk, they're doing life sentences for no just cause, for no sane reason. It's just fear, hype, and oppression rather than compassion, education, and justice. And then when you look at what is 28% of that population, it's around 190 people, the closest I can calculate this. So if 189 of MSOPs, 680-strong population, client population, are not the gravest threats to public safety, why are they in there in the first place? And then why are they in there in the first place, sapping dollars that could be used to help innocent, non-sex offending citizens out here when these dollars are scarce? If 189 that we can isolate and release tomorrow are not the gravest threats, then why did the DOC Central Office Risk Assessment experts overrule the ECRC? They have a program in place in the Minnesota Department of Corrections. It's called the End of Confinement Review Committee. You have the case manager that works with these offenders for years, law enforcement, victim services, and then there's a specific case manager that specializes in sex offenders. He's there. So the point is that the ECRC gives these guys like a level 1 or level 2. And they know what they're doing because they're specialized and they do this very well. I know who they are. I've been in front of them many times. The ECRC are good. They know what they're doing. And then for some reason, DOC's risk assessment group is referring these people. And they're winding up in MSOP as level 1 and level 2. So I understand that everybody's pressed for time. My written submissions are in. I will probably have some more written submissions coming in over the course of the session. I have a lot more information. And what I would just like to leave the panel with today is I view myself as a tremendous resource. I spent a year inside of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. For me, this is not about making a headline or making a buck. This is about getting it right, and it's about $73 million that can be going toward public safety because the MSOP is not about public safety. It is draining all of the resources that we need for public safety. So my final comment would be that I think the leadership is a real void to come in and ask for not the same amount of money with the federal court stepping on their neck. They want more money and 60 more people in there when it was 6 people a year for 20 years until Drew Shadeen. And with that, I want to thank the panel again today and wish everybody a great day.
Mr. Evanstad, thank you very much for your testimony, and your written testimony has been delivered. And if there's further, we will make sure that's distributed as well.
Thank you kindly, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we stand adjourned.